a really big shoe tonight. A really big shoe tonight.
Welcome back to Ion Leap Radio. My name is Steve St. Clair, and this show, among several others, is part of a big content marketing event about big content marketing events. And we are talking today in particular about craft in audio. If you're doing a big content marketing event and you're launching audio shows like Blog Talk Radio shows like this one, don't forget the importance of craft. The internet, in my opinion, has made it too cheap and too easy in some cases, and people forget that they need to take time to craft something right and to really make it stand out and be different. And as I was thinking through this show, I realized that I need to talk to a good friend of mine who is the undisputed expert on craft and audio production, in my opinion, Phil Lee, president and executive producer of CityVox in New York City. Phil and I go back many years. I first worked with him on Radio Shack, Outward Bound, television spots, and a whole ton of other fun projects over the years. And I've never worked with anyone who brings as much craft to audio work as Phil Lee. Welcome, Phil.
Undisputed, huh, Steve? I'm not too
That's right, about that. That's right. So, Phil, tell us, how'd you get started in audio work?
Well, I got started because my father was an engineer for CBS, and when I was about 14 years old, I guess, we got a reel-to-reel tape deck. I won't tell you what year that was. And he started teaching me how to edit tape. And when I got into high school, my high school had a radio station, and I started doing some disc jockey work on that station, and that really decided me that I was wanted to continue in radio for the rest of my life. And that hasn't happened, but radio and audio production and the human voice and music has been a very large part of my working life ever since.
Speaking of the music side, didn't you work at one point with Jimi Hendrix's Electric Lady Studio?
Yeah, I didn't work with Jimmy. He passed away about a year and a half before I started working there. But I was working at the Electric Lady, I guess it was about two or three years after I graduated from college. And it was funny how I got the job. I had been jumping around different jobs ever since I graduated, and mostly, again, trying to get into some kind of production work. And I kept on getting laid off, not fired, but all the companies I was working for were going out of business. And I had spent about 9 months on unemployment because I decided I was going to wait until I found the perfect job. And that didn't happen, and I went back to work at one of these not very interesting production companies and was again laid off in about 5 months' time and decided I didn't want to go back on unemployment. And the first job opening I saw in the Village Voice was at the Bitter End. And I went over there to run their sound system, and I interviewed with them, and they said, well, you're more than welcome to come here, but it's kind of a dead-end job, and you're only going to make $100 a week, and it's all night hours, and it's, you know, we think you have too much experience for this. However, the one good thing about it is that the last guy who was here met some people from the Electric Lady when they were here, and he's now an assistant engineer there. So on my way home from that interview, I had my resume with me, and I passed the Electric Lady. I dropped it off, and I got a call a week later to come in for an interview. And I ended up having a job where I was working about 70 hours a week for $100 a week, all crazy hours, and it was the same thing. But it was great.
Wow.
I mean, it was a really fascinating time. I was, I think, too young to appreciate fully what I was experiencing and what I was learning. But
wow.
I did.
That's an intensive introduction into that world. Holy cow.
Yeah, it really was. It most
now,
certainly
what specifically were you doing at Electric Lady?
Most of the time I was there, I was an assistant engineer, which basically meant I set up the studios, I broke them down. During the sessions, I was operating the 16-track tape machines. I wasn't allowed to do anything like editing or anything like that because it was all too precious. And but you know, you were learning how to do all that. And then, of course, I was running out and getting coffee and Coke, of different kinds of Coke, for everybody who was there. And
back in the day, yeah,
it certainly was. But that's mainly what I was doing. I ended up, before I left the place, as the studio manager, but that happened, I can't even remember how that happened. All I know is that it was basically because the place was in real turmoil, because it had never been, it was left to Jimmy's estate, and it was just being run by lawyers at that time, and they didn't know what they were doing, so they made me studio manager.
Wow. Well, that worked
but,
out.
Yeah, I was there for about 2 years.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, about 2 years.
So did that background in music production help train your ear for future audio work?
It really did, which I wasn't really aware of. The thing that I found very interesting was that the job I had after I left the Electric Lady was I worked for 5 years at the United Nations as a radio engineer and also doing some location recording for documentary films. But when I was doing the radio work, basically what I was doing was taking speeches that were given by people in various languages and editing them. And I have been a horrible student of languages my whole life and hardly speak English very well. So when I was busy editing Arabic, as an example, usually there was an Arabic speaker sitting by me and saying, okay, you cut here, you cut here. But you needed to hear it. And you could actually start listening and know when somebody had made a mistake because you were getting into the rhythm and the music of the language.
Mm.
And so listening down to speech, even speech you don't, more importantly, speech you don't understand, you start listening to the music. And to this day, I mean, the CityVox is not a music studio. We're totally post-production. But music, still all the engineers who work here have had a background in music. And I, to this day, am editing music skating programs for ice skaters, and it's all music, and you have to take anywhere from a 3 minute pop piece to a 40 minute classical piece and edit it down to 2 minutes and 10 seconds or something, and it's a skill, it's really, and I still love doing it. I love editing music.
So with that kind of ear, I imagine, and your perfectionism, I imagine that it must be killing you that we're recording this on our crappy phone microphones using Blog Talk Radio. I'll tell you what, I've never done this before, but I'm going to end this show early. If you don't mind, I'd like to come into New York into your studio, and let's add some production value to this one. Let's get behind the microphones, let's get in the booth and make this one sound the way you can make it sound. How does that sound?
That would sound great to me, Steve. I'd love it.
All right. I'll see you in a bit.
Okay, great.
So, Phil, we're back. This is what I call a proper recording facility instead of sitting in my office on a telephone.
It certainly is different, yes.
It's amazing. So just so the listeners on Blog Talk Radio understand what I'm in here, I'm in a professional New York City recording studio. I've walked into what looks like a bulletproof glass case with, I mean, this thing is super soundproof. It's got deadening, damping stuff all around it. Now, just before I walked in here, I was sitting out there, I see it through the glass, and I heard a bunch of sirens going down the New York City streets, which happens every 10 seconds. Now,
right.
Nothing.
Right. Well, it's interesting. The control room where you were, even there we have double-glazed windows so that it lessens the sound outside. It's rare that you ever have a recording studio with any windows for exactly for that reason, because it's really hard to cut down the sound from the street. In the booth that we're in now, we also have a window, mm-hmm. which I have never seen.
Yeah.
And we triple glazed that
wow.
window, and it really does make a difference. There are still times when if there's a fire engine or an emergency vehicle going right below the window, we got to stop recording.
Mm-hmm.
But it's rare.
Yeah,
and
that's cool.
And I'm thrilled. I mean, I've been working in this business for 40 years. This is the first time I've ever worked in a studio with windows.
Yeah, I never thought about it, but I don't recall ever seeing one.
Yeah, it's
in
great.
My years in it. Now, I'm talking into a microphone that's a lot different than my telephone that we were using a second ago. Tell me about this. And what else? We have an engineer behind the glass. That's Dave. And
right.
I remember Dave from years ago working with you. We'll get into that. But so the equipment-wise, what's going on here?
Well, there's a lot of things that make a professional studio what it is. And actually, the most important, I think, is what we started talking about, which is the audio booth. Any vocal audio booth is a very dead room. So in other words, there's soundproofing on all the walls. And it's not necessarily so much to keep the sound out as it is to keep the reflection to a minimum so that the voice doesn't reflect back into the microphone. So it's very clean with no reverberance at all. The other thing about this room, if you notice, is that there isn't one wall here that is at right angles to another.
Oh, I didn't notice.
And the ceiling. It's all because if it were more, it gives you more opportunity for reflection.
Never noticed that.
Yeah. And the floor is what we call floated, which means it's about 3-4 inches above the ground, and there's soundproofing between the actual concrete floor mm-hmm. of the building and what the floor is here. So it's all to create this very dead quality. If you're in a music studio, you still have all the soundproofing of the walls and the floor. You don't of the... You want more bounce. You want more reverberation.
Oh.
They're more live studios, and it's a different feel. We have recorded music in these rooms, and we have to add the reverberation artificially.
To make it sound more like a live experience.
To make it sound... Because it really sounds pretty dead here.
Oh, okay.
That's the first thing. Then... As you mentioned, the microphones. What we're working on now are two Neumann U87 condenser mics, which cost around, I don't know, Dave, about $5,000 each now, something like that, I think.
A brand new one costs in the ballpark new at
$3,500.
I think these, since they're older, are probably worth
more, yeah. Anyway.
So my Macintosh, which has that little snowball thing, not quite so good. I was quite pleased with myself.
But, you know, it's amazing because with digital technology, the mics are some of the most important. They always are the most important, but some of the most expensive pieces of equipment you're going to have in a studio now. When we started buying tape recorders, 16-track tape recorder was at least $80,000 to $100,000.
Wow.
And now you can get a whole digital setup for $10,000 to $12,000 that can do an infinite amount of tracks.
Right.
So it's changed dramatically in that regard.
We're going to get into that, too. That difference between where it was and where it is now, I want to dwell on. But first, a little more background. You and I first met when you were Full House Productions.
Right.
I believe we were working on something with David Leitch for Outward Bound. That's how he introduced me to you, I think.
I think so. That's right.
David was a still photographer. I think he still is in New York here. And he wanted to get into film, so we started doing some commercials together on the side for fun. And I loved working with you right off the bat. And kept coming back to you at Full House Productions, which got quite large. But then you started CityVox, where we are now. So what was the genesis of CityVox?
Well, as you say, Full House got quite large. We were in a space on 18th Street that was about 10,000 square feet. And after a few years, I ended up being more of a landlord than I was a studio owner. And it was just getting to be really difficult. So we decided to close Full House after about 25 years, I guess it was, and kind of pull back, consolidate. So we had four studios on 18th Street. We have two here. The most important people we had working at Full House are working here at CityVox. And we're doing exactly the same work we were doing at Full House, just a lot more efficiently.
And it's going well. One of your big clients is still English as a second language.
Yeah, we do a lot of educational English as a second language programs. In the other studio right now, there's IBM doing text-to-speech. There was a thing they did about 10 years ago, the robot Watson.
Mm-hmm.
We did all the recording for that here.
Oh, cool.
And then our other big prestigious client is Ken Burns. We do all their voiceover work at CityVox.
Yeah, and have for years, as I recall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's great.
For a good 20, 25 years.
So you worked on the Civil War.
We didn't. One of the engineer who's working with us, who Ken loves to work with, who is getting close to 80 now, and he's still wonderful. Was working with them in a studio that we merged with, which is
Okay. So, Phil, one of the things I counsel clients on, and especially with regards to a big content event, which is what we're sort of talking about here, is not to accept or feel bound to internet quality on everything they're doing, especially in video and audio. Now, I don't know about you. I hear and see a lot on the internet. And it troubles me sometimes the way things sound and the way they look. I just recently posted a blog post about 2160 pixels per inch that YouTube is now allowing, super HD when you're watching a YouTube video, if it's filmed in 2160.
Mm-hmm.
Audio, though, I hear just again and again this sort of thin quality to it, the lack of finesse in the edits. The poor mixing, if there's any mixing at all.
Right.
How do you feel about that? Let's talk about that for a minute. How does it feel with you, coming from your background, where you were cutting things apart with a razor blade?
Yeah. It's progress, and there's not much you can do to stop it. More and more of our clients are requesting MP3 files, which are compressed files, that no matter what you do, you can't make them sound all that great. And but they're all going onto the internet, and that's what they want to do. However, what you can do, and what obviously we do, is record them in the best quality ways we possibly can, so that by the time it gets down to MP3s, at least everything else, the room, the mic, the recording chain is all professionally done. And most importantly, the engineer who's behind that board knows what they're doing and creates a really good sounding thing to begin with. So, yeah, if you were able to send them out on WAV files, which are full bandwidth files, they would sound phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
On MP3s, they don't sound as good, but they sound a lot better than they do if you're recording on a snowball mic.
That's for sure.
You know?
Or telephone, blog talk radio.
Exactly. And I, you know, certainly understand it's really quantity over quality right now. It's because the more compressed files, the quicker they're going to upload and the more you can get on online.
An interesting thing happened video-wise with the launch of the iPhone 6 all of a sudden. People are making HD videos, and I think the 5 allowed it too, but the 6 is stunning because you can go to slow motion mode, You can do all sorts of cool stuff, stop motion. So maybe this will make some sort of comeback. I doubt it. I'm not sure people really can hear, you know, the importance of good audio quality. But my point in this show, and the reason we did it this way, is that I want people to hear the difference between the two and understand that there are times when you ought to go into a situation like we're standing in now. It's just a subtle difference. We didn't talk about it before. But as we were starting this, before we started recording, Dave in the other room was, I suspect, balancing our two microphones.
Absolutely.
You're standing a little further back. I'm a little closer. And I saw him in there sort of working away balancing microphones. Tell me a little more about the finesse that goes on in these rooms. Because if you can make my nasal voice sound like anything at all, it's a miracle.
The thing about recording anything, but let's talk about voice, is that it's experience. You can throw somebody in front of a microphone and you can record them. But if you've got two people in a room, like you and me, we've got different quality voices. So you have to know how to balance between those two. You have to know the difference of recording a female voice to a male voice, somebody who's softly spoken to someone who is projecting a lot more. And most especially, and we do this a lot with our ESL programs, we have four or five people in this room at the same time. And usually two, sometimes three mics up. And to get it so that you're not getting a bleed from one mic to another, so that it sounds kind of echoey, which is a real problem, you just need to know exactly how to do all that work, and it's what the engineers do brilliantly.
Right, and the guy on the other side of the glass there, Dave, has been with you. You guys have been working together a long time, I know.
We've been working together about 20 years, I think.
Yeah, so that's tremendous. And that brings up another point. Beyond just audio production quality, you were always well-connected in the industry and could always recommend the best voice talent. And that's another advantage, I think, of working with a good craftsman. You have the ear, you develop these relationships with people, and you hang on to those. I've met so many great voice talents through you guys.
I think in the work we do, in terms of content, that's 90% of it, if you get a good voice talent. And especially, again, this ESL stuff we do is very specific. And if you get people who've been working on it for a while, they save your ass all the time. You don't have to communicate too much to them. They look at the script. They know exactly what they need to do. But again, it's the same. You're working with professionals. And yeah, that's so important, whether it's a voice talent, a good engineer, a good producer, whatever. It's paramount.
Yeah. I remember one time I was in a studio. I was a creative director of an ad agency here in New York. And I got a call from the producer. She was in a panic. She said, we're on take 40. At some point, they were recording some tracks for radio or TV, I forget which. She said, can you get up here and run this? So I get up there, and it's one of our junior writers, and he just didn't know how it worked. And no one had told him, you know, you can't abuse these guys. This was a top-level talent.
Wow.
So as I'm walking into the studio, I look through the glass, and I make my thumbs up or thumbs down, and he takes his thumb and goes, distinctly down.
The talent.
Like, the talent is not pleased. And so I get in the recording room, and I'm like, how's it going, guys? What take are we on? And I already knew. But he's like, well, 42. They got two or three more takes from the time it took me to get there. And I said, well, let me try one. So I take the little mic. I talk to the talent in the booth. I'm like, Joe, what would you do? He said, well, can I try one? I'm like, yeah, do one. So, and the writer says, aren't you going to give me a direction? I'm like, nah, this guy's done this for years. Go. And he does it, and he nails it.
Of course
he did. I said, Joe, give us one more like that, just as a backup. He did. And I'm like, I don't know about you guys. I think we're done. and it was cool. And he learned, the younger writer learned, trust the talent.
Absolutely.
And the talent learned, you know, always work with Steve St. Clair.
Exactly. There you go.
So
that's great. That's a great story. And I've been in a lot of sessions like that. It's very true.
And it's learning. It's really learning the talent. And I can't name all the guys you connected me to. They're great. There's one other interesting thing. You guys you're also an executive producer. And I think one of the things that's getting left out, and I see it with clients who do their own audio sometimes, like they'll do whatever, their own voice tracks for their telephone answering. I forget what you call that system.
Voice prompts.
Voice prompts. They'll do their own voice prompts, and they'll go directly in the studio and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Why should they use a producer?
In audio, there's at least in the area that we work in, there's a fine line between a producer and a director. It's exactly what you were just talking about with walking into the studio and knowing what you're doing and knowing how to communicate with your talent. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we'll be given a script, whether it be a commercial 30-second script or an ESL 300-page script. And we got to kind of look at that script, break it down, determine which talent would be best to work with, figure out, especially if it's a longer script, what the schedule is going to be and how many talent you need to work on it, and put together the session, the whole project, from choosing the talent to deciding how long it's going to take to record this to just getting the whole thing complete. Then you go into the session, and you usually have, whether it be in the educational stuff, it's usually editors we have sitting behind us. In the commercial work, when we're producing, we have the writers, basically. What our job then is to act as a liaison between the editors, the art director, whatever, and the talent, and to direct the talent in the way that our clients want us to do that. I have worked with some who are sitting in back of me who understand what communicating with a talent means. Like, if you were sitting behind me and you wanted to get on the talkback mic, I would not have a problem in the world. Other people will say something and it'll push the session back 2 hours and just get people frustrated. Me, the talent, everybody. So that's where a really good director comes in, knowing how to communicate with the talent, basically, mm-hmm. and how to get the best out of them. And if that's having Joe do his own read, which it very often is, that's great. Mm-hmm. You understand that, and that's very important.
I'm very lucky, too. I have two clients who've been in the agency world. Another has been in the professional radio world, and they both really get it when it comes to this and video and other things. And they understand the level of craft necessary, and they appreciate working with guys like you. And they understand the value of it, because it costs more than my little stupid snowball mic, you know?
Absolutely, it does. But
you get something much better as a result. So, Phil, let's look down the road at some of the big changes coming in the next few years. Where do you see this going? I mean, it's certainly come a long way since the last 10 years or so.
The biggest change in the last 20 years has been from analog to digital. And where it's going digitally, I honestly have no idea. The only thing I know, I think for sure, is that the distribution of content will be less and less on hard media like CDs, and it's just all going to be streaming. I'm sure of that. Which, again, means that it's going to be compressed files, and that's just the way of the world right now. The one thing that gives me some real hope, which is very strange but I think is really wonderful, is this interest among younger people in vinyl, and that records are coming back into vogue. Boy, to listen to an old LP, the quality, it's just a whole different experience. And the fact that people are probably for the first time in their lives experiencing that and reacting in a positive way to it, it may just be a small little niche, but I'm thrilled that that's happening.
You know, when the internet really started to get big, everyone predicted the death of magazines, the death of printed books. Right. It's not the case.
No.
And people are reverting back to books. Yeah, Kindle's there. It's more portable. But my own wife is in a book club, and they're not going to Kindle. They like the old hardbacks and paperbacks.
Absolutely.
You know? So I think it just adds to our experience. It doesn't necessarily completely kill things.
No.
We'll see. So, Phil, this has been great. I want to thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
It's been a lot of fun, as it always is, throughout our career here. And to the listening audience, I want to thank you for joining myself with Phil Lee. You can learn more about Phil Lee and his company, CityVox, at www.cityvoxny.com. Or you can pick up the phone and call and ask for Phil Lee at 212-645-2228. When you get to the website, there's a list of services about a mile long. That's what all those years of experience gets you. And I'm not going to touch on them all, Phil. They'll have to go to cityvoxny.com. But TV, radio, film, audio, mixing, audio editing and mastering, sound design, Pro Tools, digital multi-track recording, casting, which is big. It's helped me a lot. Post-production with Lock to QuickTime Video, radio spots, presentations, and I'm only about a third of the way down the list. Phil, let's get together soon. I want to thank your engineer but through the other side of the glass, David. It's amazing. I can't wait to hear it on the other end.
Me too.
And thank we'll talk you, soon, Steve. Guys. Thanks, everybody, for listening to another episode of Ion Leap Marketing.
This has been an Ion Leap podcast.